CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Hi, dear listeners. This is Kate Riga. I'm here to make a quick pitch that you consider becoming a TPM Prime member. TPM has used the member model for over a decade now, and our loyal members are the only reason we've been able to weather the turbulence of the media landscape and avoid the fate that has befallen so many other independent outlets. For $70, you get no paywall, fewer ads, access to the Hive member forum, a members-only newsletter, and more. For $140 a year, you get all of that, plus no ads at all. Without our members, there is no podcast, not to mention that I'm out of a job. Thank you so much for listening and supporting us. We couldn't do it without you. Hello and welcome to Belaboring the Point. I'm your host, Kate Riga, and I'm lucky enough to be joined today by our own Josh Kavinsky, who's here to tell us what it's like to be on the inside of the Trump trials. Josh, welcome. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me on, Kate.
So let's just start with kind of set the scene for us. Like, when do you get there in the morning? Do you have a little routine? You know, what's it like inside? What can you see from the room where you're sitting? Just take us inside with you.
Sure. So I get there usually around 6 a.m. basically because they're, yeah, so that's kind of rough. I mean, the issue is that there are a limited number of spaces in the courthouse. There are two rooms where you can watch the trial from, and they're both on the upper floor of the courthouse beyond a Secret Service kind of cordon. So to get in, you have to go through the regular sort of security that you go in to get at any courthouse, and then you go up to this like kind of upper floor, and there's a whole separate like ring of security to get through with Secret Service. Behind that, you have the main courtroom where you can see Trump. I was in there on Friday. And then there is the overflow courtroom where they're providing live audio and video of the proceedings. And so, you know, there's a limited number of seats in both. And so to ensure that we at TPM have a spot, I have to get there pretty early. So that's one thing. You know, I think the whole sort of atmosphere, one thing that's kind of odd about covering trials in general, but this one specifically, is that there ends up being this sort of like community or like a college industry which forms around the trial itself. Like, you know, we have all these like kind of TV lawyers who are showing up. There's all these different people from members of the public who are interested. And like, you get used to kind of seeing the same faces every day. And there's a lot of time in the line, you know, when you're standing around like 2 or 3 hours at 7 a.m. to like mingle and talk to people. So that's been kind of an interesting aspect of it. But in terms of the way it works once you get inside, I think it you can really feel the presence of the Secret Service. The way it works is that once you get in either the main courtroom or the overflow, if Trump is on the move, then nothing can happen. Everybody has to stay in place. And if you get screamed at or, you know, kicked out if you violate any kind of order. So that's one thing. They do have a camera microphone situation set up in the hallway from the wherever lounge the defense hangs out in to the courtroom, where Trump will stop and give remarks. So like, for example, on Monday, as I was going in, I was kind of stuck waiting in the security line when Trump went out to do that. And so we all had to kind of freeze, and the, you know, cops were like yelling at people. Like, if people even looked at their phones, they were like, don't do that. It's like really crazy kind of like security theater, but it's wild because, you know, Trump just starts talking and it is like just this in-person version of like these like sound bites that you've just heard kind of every week or day for the past 8 years, like just kind of coming out of his mouth. And it's like, it's almost like uncanny to hear how like ready made it all is. So that's definitely an aspect of it as well.
And are there like a lot of protesters outside the courtroom? It almost seems like this is something that Trump is like insecure about, that there aren't that many of his fans out there. You know, what is it like?
Yeah, I mean, there's almost nobody. You know, the first day there were a few. There were probably between 50 or so people, maybe closer to 100 on the first day, protesters and counter protesters. But since then, there's really been like, I mean, I would say like single digit numbers showing up to protest. And, you know, just for listeners' reference, there's a big park across from the courthouse, Collect Pond Park. So it's kind of a natural space where people show up. But yeah, I mean, you know, yesterday there was a Russian Orthodox guy walking around with a big cross and a bell with on his back. He had this like thing taped, which said George Washington, John F. Kennedy, Donald Trump, greatest presidents. And that was, you know, but like that is sort of the like caliber of protester that we're dealing with at the moment. Like, it's not like we're getting, you know, like 100 people who are like, you know, Trump devotees to give up, you know, however much of their time to do this. It's like, it really, my sense is that it's mostly people who don't really have anywhere else to go who are coming. And again, it's very few. It's like single digits.
It kind of reminds me of the space outside of the White House where habitually there are people there kind of set up shop protesting for causes you've like never heard of before.
Yeah. And then there's also these guys who just like, you know, their just whole thing is that they are protesting. So like there's one guy who was like, keeps showing up with a big sign that says like the Jews control TikTok. And like, I don't think he's like a necessarily like a Trump guy, but it's with him. It's like, it's at least some of the, you say, yeah, like single digit or like low double digit protest numbers. But even of those, you have these people who are just like, they just have some bizarre cause, and this is just like an opportunity for them to like get attention.
Right. Totally. Okay. So obviously we started with juror selection, which was a whole kind of minefield, but can you talk a little bit about how you negotiated what to report about the jurors, especially when, you know, it seemed to me like a lot of outlets were not at all concerned about potentially like outing these people. And obviously we already saw that, you know, the chickens come home to roost a little bit with at least one juror excused on the basis that people in her life were already recognizing her.
Yeah, it was really weird because the way it worked was that from the overflow room, where at that point almost all the reporters were, because the space in the main courtroom was being used for the jurors, you know, you couldn't see the jurors' like faces or bodies, but you could see, you could hear their responses to the questionnaire. And so the jury questionnaire included questions that were extremely relevant to the case. Like directly relevant, like, you know, what's your opinion of Donald Trump? Do you think he's being treated fairly? Do you have any reason that you might not be able to be fair and impartial because of your political views or whatever it might be? Then there are also sort of basic biographical questions they look for. And so those are, you know, educational background, employer, name of your employer, your spouse's employer and the name of your spouse's employer, any nonprofit organizations or volunteer or advocacy organizations in which you might be involved. So, you know, from the standpoint of an attorney trying to deduce, you know, how somebody might eventually vote or view a case, it's all incredibly useful information. But like in this case, you had, you know, for example, there was one juror who was not selected who was a educator at a fairly well-known school in the New York City area. And this person, you know, when you heard that, like sitting in the room, it was immediately obvious that like, it would take probably 30 seconds of Googling to figure out this person's identity, even though we weren't given this person's name. And so, you know, to me, and I think to my editor, it was pretty clear off the bat that like in a situation where you have a presidential candidate, potentially a future president who has a long history of going after witnesses, it wasn't, I think, that hard of a decision to not publish the names of these people's employers or other identifying information. Like, we didn't do that, which I'm very proud of. So that was one thing. You know, I do think, though, that it is really difficult because the flip side of the argument is that, you know, the jurors' identities in this case are protected, and that's by the judge's order. And that is because, you know, Trump is very willing to threaten and apply pressure, right, to get what he wants. He doesn't really have if he has a sense of what the boundaries are, he's happy to disregard them to pursue his ends. So there's a real need and interest in their protection, but you know, there's also a public interest in knowing who's making these decisions. I mean, they are given a lot of power, the jurors. They are employees of the judiciary for the duration of the case. And so there is, I think, a public interest still in having at least a broad sense of their identities, of who's making these decisions. And just the upshot of jury selection, in my view, was that they got about as Republican a pool as you could get in Manhattan. You have a couple of attorneys, they're corporate attorneys. You have a couple of MBAs who work on Wall Street. You know, the person you mentioned who withdrew that potential juror, I mean, she was like an oncology nurse. But the point is you just have a lot of people who I think it's not like these are all like, you know, a public school teacher, like activists, like union members or like some like really core Democratic constituency. I mean, these are people, some of whom who said that they, you know, during jury selection, that they sympathize with Trump's economic policies. You know, people who expressed pretty complicated views and weren't, I think, at least as I saw it, like immediately turned off by a lot of the behavior that we've covered in CPM.
That's just so interesting to hear because, you know, I mean, he's going to the bag he always goes to, which is, you know, it's a witch hunt and it's a political prosecution. I'm being treated kind of singularly unfairly. And then to hear that this jury pool was so carefully selected in a way that it might have given him the best possible shot he could have, you know, it all kind of undermines that constant refrain of grievance.
Yeah. And here's the thing, you know, if let's say there's a mistrial and for that, you only need one juror to say that they can't reach a decision, Trump is going to say that's a victory for kind of obvious reasons. And so all they need is one person on a panel of 12 to say that they're unwilling to vote, that they're unwilling to go through with it. So, you know, the bar is low, I think, for in that regard for a victory. But at the same time, they do a really good job of selecting for people who take this seriously. I mean, that's one of the main things. One of the interesting things about the process was, you know, okay, if you've been in jury duty or listeners have been in jury duty, one thing you realize is like, it's really hard to get out of it, especially when the judge is sitting there like questioning people. Like, but with this, it was the opposite. It's the only time I've ever seen this where, you know, if somebody, what they did was they brought in 96 people into the courtroom. They asked everybody, all right, who thinks they might not be able to be impartial? And if you raised your hand, then you were immediately dismissed from the courtroom and you could go home. And that was it. And that's just like incredibly unusual. Like I remember covering a trial like years ago where like the judge was like arguing with people. This is a federal case. The judge was like arguing with people who said they couldn't be impartial. And it was like, it was to make a point partly, but he was like stunned. And so it's odd to see the opposite.
Right. So one thing I've heard, you know, from liberals especially is that they're worried that some kind of MAGA mole will sneak their way onto the jury and then, you know, determinedly vote not to convict no matter what and to give that mistrial. What do you think the chances are that that's happened here?
I actually think it's a fairly low, the chances are fairly low. And I would point back to the Paul Manafort trial. And this is like reaching way back into the, you know, like mists of time, but people I think might like, but what happened there was you had a jury that took quite a long time to deliberate. I mean, I think it was a couple weeks. Actually, I'm completely wrong. It was only a couple days. Let me
felt like weeks.
Yeah. Okay. So the Paul Manafort trial, you had a jury that took a couple of days to deliberate. And after they deliberated, they found that they acquitted Manafort on 10 out of the 18 counts, and they only found him guilty on 8. And rather, instead of the remaining 10, it was a mistrial. It wasn't an acquittal. And, you know, the prosecution, they took the victory and didn't try him. But the point is that you had people on that jury in the Manafort case who were Trump supporters, and they were Republicans. But they looked at the evidence, and they decided, all right, you know, he's guilty. And maybe, you know, Manafort, if there had been a different jury pool, it wouldn't have been 8 out of 18 charges that he was convicted on. But that's kind of just how things go. And there's a broader point here, which I think is important, which is that, you know, the entire system is not going to work if we adopt this view that, you know, just because a defendant has engendered, you know, political views about themselves, that means it's impossible for people who follow politics or hold political views, like everybody does at this point about Trump, to render a fair judgment. I mean, the idea is that, you know, regardless of, you know, where we might be across on the political spectrum, you can be MAGA, you can be a Democrat, whatever, you're able in the jury room, the jury box, to look at the evidence that's been presented to you and see if it matches the law. And, you know, it's just a principle we all have to obey, and it's the principle that underpinned all of jury selection. And I might note, it's a principle that Trump, like, basically tried to put on trial throughout jury selection.
Right. Right. So let's get into kind of the meat of the trial. We've had opening statements, which are our first sense of how each side is going to craft their argument, kind of the broad contours there. So what's your kind of quick hit impression of how the prosecution and defense are going to aim to like frame their whole argument in the coming weeks?
So the prosecution is painting they have a broad narrative, and the narrative is one of, yeah, it's a hush money scheme, but there's a broader meaning to it. And it's that Trump was using the hush money arrangement to corrupt the 2016 presidential election. And he did that by, concealing information from the public after the Access Hollywood tape. That's the Stormy Daniels, the revelation of the affair with Stormy Daniels. And, corruptly reimbursing, falsifying business records to reimburse his attorney, Michael Cohen, in exchange for having paid the hush money payments to Stormy Daniels. So it attempts to take what is a fairly narrow, I think it's fair to say, set of charges, falsifying business records in furtherance of this conspiracy to violate campaign finance laws, and make it about something much bigger, I think correctly, which is kind of just distorting the 2016 presidential election. So that's the prosecution. I mean, kind of in the broadest sense of what they're arguing. For the defense, it is a bit more piecemeal. They have less of like an overarching narrative, but are instead, as I think defense attorneys often do in these cases, they're just aiming at undermining the prosecution, because the burden of proof is on the prosecutors. And what they're saying is that basically everybody the prosecution is relying on to make this argument is fatally self-interested. The biggest example of that is Michael Cohen, the attorney who paid off Stormy Daniels and who allegedly received the payments from Donald Trump as reimbursement for that. The defense is going to say, and they already have said, that Cohen is a liar, that he's a convicted felon, and that he's not credible because he's changed his story on this so many times, that he was as vehement in his support for President Trump before he flipped as he has been vehement in his opposition to Trump now that he's on the other side. They're going to basically portray him as a turncoat and just fundamentally not credible. What's going to be harder for them, I think, is the extent to which prosecutors have documentary evidence which goes beyond Cohen's assertions. Part of this is because of how Trump operates. He, as we've seen, I think, over several years, he's actually really, really good at keeping reasonable and plausible distance from the kind of dirty things that go wrong around him in order to protect him. In this case, for example, you have Cohen, who is his attorney, so he's legally acting on his behalf, and you have David Pecker, the National Enquirer CEO, AMI CEO, and a longtime kind of friend and associate of Trump's, both, making these hush money arrangements kind of go into effect in a way which really does help Trump and protects him during his candidacy. And so you can look at this and be like, well, how could Trump possibly not have known about this? Because it's an employee of his, it's a friend of his, doing things which directly benefit him as he is running for president, right? And that's kind of what the prosecution would have you say, but the defense is going to ask jurors to look at that and be like, look, and say, we need to have direct evidence that Trump was directing Cohen and Pecker to do this, that he was responsible for, he was the one arranging all this, making sure that it happened. The evidence for that is going to be trickier. I mean, maybe there are documents, we're not clear yet, there's a recording which Cohen has, but I think part of it is going to come down to how much the prosecution can get the jury to overcome whatever doubts they have about Cohen and the other sort of sordid figures in the Trump universe, and how many documents that they can bring to bear, which go beyond the words of any one person.
Well, it strikes me that, Pecker, who's already taken the stand, is also of this kind of grimy, underbelly New York tabloidy world. How did that translate to the stand? And did you kind of take any lessons from that might be applicable when, Cohen's up later, who, as you say, stands on perhaps like wobbly credibility overall?
Yeah, I mean, Pecker is like a funny character. I mean, he just imagined who might the National Enquirer CEO be. I mean, Pecker is just like he's literally
out of central casting. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. He's like incarnate of that. And he is just such like a glad hander. People were talking about this, that when he walked into the courtroom, he was just like grinning at everybody. And he was like, at some point, I guess when he left on like Monday, he tried to like say hello to somebody at the defense table. Very weird. And even when he was testifying, and he kept like trying to ingratiate himself, like he was saying, like, you know, he called Trump at one point the most eligible bachelor, or like the ultimate boss or something like that. Like, it was really like over the top, even though he's an adverse witness to Trump. So, you know, Pecker, I think, offers a few things, which are damaging to Trump legally, but also politically. So here's one thing. The way that Pecker describes all of these interactions is in this like really heavy-handed, like kind of mafioso, like Sopranos way of doing business. So like there's this meeting, which the prosecutors really like to talk about, April 2015. So a month or two after Trump announced it for his run for office, where Trump and Cohen invite Pecker to this meeting, and they basically say, you know, what can you do to help the campaign? Like, and it's very like, you know, like, all right, it's just really like mafia style, like mm-hmm. business. And the outcome of the meeting is that Pecker, he says, agrees to act as eyes and ears for the Trump campaign, identify negative stories and kill them, and also use his properties to run positive stories about Trump and negative stories about his opponents. So the whole thing, though, is just really like sleazy. And they're all like so deeply involved in this like world. Like, I'm not trying to be moralistic about this at all. Like, it's very funny, but they're all so deeply involved in this world that they don't even like know like what they're, they don't seem to really understand how it comes off to everybody else. So you have Pecker up there grinning, talking about how he practices like checkbook journalism, where, you know, you're basically just like paying sources for stories, just like completely, the rest of the world is like completely unethical, right? But he's just like, oh yeah, it's just the way I do. Like, so there's a lot of that. And I think it's damaging to the jury because you just kind of see like how these people are just like fundamentally unscrupulous. And I think it's damaging to Trump more broadly because, you know, it's not like this is new information, but, you know, we're just focusing on this like nonstop for 6 weeks or more.
More of this scintillating content after these messages.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey. Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Back to the show. So like you said, the defense doesn't really have to like craft a narrative of events. They just have to blow holes in the prosecutions. But it does strike me that once we kind of get beyond the broad strokes of, you know, this is a political prosecution that shouldn't have been brought, and, you know, this is how elections work, this is the dirty reality of politics. Like, when we get into the fact patterns, it does seem like they're going to have some kind of theory to counter the prosecution's narrative that, you know, Trump was the kind of puppet master here. And when I was just kind of thinking about this in a casual way, it was just, you know, what is the alternate series of events? Is it just that kind of Cohen acting on his own reconnaissance and without Trump's involvement killed a story that, you know, wasn't true in the first place?
Yeah. I mean, the big thing is that I think what they're trying to do is say that Michael Cohen never stopped being Trump's attorney, that he was always acting as attorney for Donald Trump, and that therefore there was no mislabeling of business records, which is the kind of core of the charge, right? In fact, these were just payments to Michael Cohen for his services as an attorney. And there wasn't a reimbursement at all. So I think that is going to be the core. That's going to be core of their argument. It's going to be the narrative that you described. But I think that there is a broader thing going on here, which is that throughout his opening statement, Todd Blanche, Trump's attorney, he said something, but specifically towards the end, he sort of said to the jurors, and this is verbatim, like, look, you know, we're all New Yorkers. That's why we're here. You know, and he was just sort of saying, it's like, look, I mean, we all get like how the world works. works, you know, so let's not like make too big a deal out of this. And it was this kind of like, it was this really interesting moment where he is like kind of calling on their cynicism to emerge. And particularly when you think about the jury composition, like the fact that you have these people who, you know, do work at like high levels of like finance and law. I mean, you know, it's people who are experienced in the world and know that it can be unseemly, I think. And so it really was this like call for cynicism, I think, for jurors to look at the prosecution's case and say, you know, regardless of like what narrative, whether or not these payments were, you know, basically just like payment to Michael Cohen for his legal work or reimbursements for his payment to Stormy Daniels, and such money payments to Stormy Daniels. It's like a call for resignation for people to just sort of be like, well, this is just the dirty reality that we live in. And like, why should we really care?
Which is funny because it's almost a big ask of the jury because, you know, the jury isn't deciding like, should this case have been brought, you know, is it a kind of valid case under this New York law? They'll be answering on these like specific charges, right? Of do you think this was falsified? All the kind of more specific things. So it's interesting that they're almost trying to sell this like broader narrative when the jurors will be kind of engaging in these specific fact patterns.
Yeah, but what I really think it is it's a, again, a victory would be a mistrial. And I really think it's a call for it's a call for a mistrial. Because at a certain point, yeah, like you can raise the bar, the standard of evidence, the bar for conviction very high. But my guess is that they're going to, you know, we have this recording of Trump talking about at least the Karen McDougal hush money payments. My guess is they're going to come out with enough to place Trump at the center of this. And then, you know, the best bet for the defense is not acquittal, it's mistrial.
Right. Okay. That's really interesting. So one thing that Trump blusters about all the time is like, he says he'll take the stand. And this is a version of, I mean, he does this constantly, you know, I'm on my way to XYZ and then doesn't show up. Do you think there's any chance the defense actually puts him on the stand?
I don't know. It would be really risky, but they did go through this whole Sandoval hearing, in which they, you know, figured out what on what topics Trump could be cross-examined by the prosecution if he does take the stand as a defense witness. You know, I really don't know because I'm kind of split minds on this. Like, I mostly kind of agree with what you said, which is that Trump always promises he's going to do things like this, take the stand in the case, or, you know, walk to the Capitol with the protesters, whatever it might be, right? He's going to put himself like front and center of whatever the event might be without any regard for his own personal safety or, you know, future. And the reality is he just doesn't follow through on that, right? It's more useful for him to say that and then just not do it. But in this case, you know, I think that there are other kind of weirder benefits to him doing that. The big elephant in the room here with jury selection and how and all these like threats he's made to witnesses kind of implicitly to jurors is that he could be president in 9 months. I mean, that's the thing. And I think like he right now he looks very he does not look dominant sitting in the defense box with the judge kind of towering over him in this really sort of dingy, like drafty courtroom.
Freezing.
Yeah. And so, like, yeah, so you have like, the judge, the witness, and the jury like, physically, literally, like above him. And when I think about, you know, yeah, is he going to testify? I think, yeah, probably not. But if he did, it might, you know, serve to kind of put him in this more dominant role, but also remind jurors, if they hadn't forgotten, you know, this guy could be president. And I don't think we can discount that. I think nobody has said that explicitly, but it just shapes everything in the trial.
Right. Okay. Just a couple more questions for you. One of which is that the Trump lawyers are pretty actively pissing off the judge already a few days into this trial, right? We had Merchan say just the other day to Todd Blanche that he's losing all credibility with the court. Yeah. I mean, and part of this seems like a natural knock-on effect of if you're going to fight against the process, I mean, the judge is part of the process, but, you know, there's a reason why most normal legal teams try to win the judge over to their side, not to kind of alienate him right out of the gate. So how do you think that kind of plays into this case, especially because you followed some of these others where, you know, the amount of leeway the judge is willing to kind of give the Trump team ends up being an important part of how things unfold. You know, how is the judge kind of acting in this case? And how do you think this antagonism from the Trump side will play out?
So I think one theme which has emerged in a lot of the cases, like I think both like on the in the particular with like, you know, each particular case he's been involved in, and then just more broadly with like the just judiciary, is that they start off giving Trump a lot of leeway. You know, like, look, you know, you're a president, you're a former president, whatever, and we're going to like really use kid gloves on you and give you a huge benefit of the doubt. And he just like abuses that and runs with it in a way which is like just it just sort of exudes disrespect for the court, right? And so then pretty quickly by the end of the process, the judges just stuck up and they feel like they've been humiliated. You know, I mean, you see that, I think, in like a lot of different instances. It's not just the criminal cases. You saw it in some of the civil disputes. And I think some people say you can like see it with some Supreme Court cases that he's been involved in. I don't know. It's not my area. But it with this, with Mershon, it he made that remark about Blanche losing credibility with the court in the context of this contempt hearing, right? Where Trump has made all of these remarks pretty clearly in violation of a gag order, attacking witnesses, in one case, you know, like probably attacking the jury. And it was interesting to me that Mershon trained his rage at the attorney and not the clients, because it has also seemed to me that Blanche is very much being kind of driven by Trump. Like, he's making arguments and saying things which don't necessarily make a lot of sense unless you have Trump as the client. For example, during opening arguments, he went out of his way to explain that we're going to call Trump President Trump out of respect. You know, it's the kind of thing like that where it's like, it's like there wasn't, how much of a deed was there? You know, say, maybe you could argue there is some need, but I wasn't really, it just felt jarring and weird. So, you know, my guess is Mershon knows that, right? So it was, you know, that was the context when she was saying that to Blanche. And Blanche kind of specifically had been arguing that, you know, he just did not understand that the gag order applied to Trump reposting things, not just him posting things, which also was kind of ridiculous on its face.
Yeah.
So it was Mershon reacting to all that. In terms of how it's going to play out, you know, further down the road in the trial, the thing is that, you know, there's throughout a trial, there are lots and lots of different motions that both lawyers have to file, and there are objections to various forms of testimony, to exhibits. And so you want the judge to think that you're credible and that you're a good faith actor, because you want him to rule for you and help you shape the evidence the jury sees, maybe shape the instructions the judge issues to the jury in hopes of getting a favorable outcome, right? And so all of these antics that Trump has done and kind of pushes lawyers to participate in, you know, are not helping in that mission, I would say. The other point that I would raise for Blanche, which is interesting, is that, you know, one thing a lot of people talk about is that the attorneys who have worked for Trump do not end up in great places. You have Michael Cohen is like the you know, the clearest example of this, right? But if the worst thing that happens to Blanche is he gets yelled at by a judge, you know, that's not the worst thing in the world for him. So we'll see.
Right. Kind of stemming from that, you mentioned earlier how this is such an undignified posture for Trump, which is funny because there's all this lead up to the trial and you had all these people very earnestly saying, you know, this helps Trump, right? This is just going to rile up his base and convince everyone that it's a witch hunt. And I never believed that. And even I was still kind of struck by the first day of how unusual it is to see Trump forced to do something he doesn't want to do for a long time. You know, this is a man who hasn't like gone anywhere or done anything he doesn't want to do in decades. And now he's kind of forced to sit down and shut up and just be there every day or risk being put in jail and all this. And I'm just, it seems so unlikely to me that he's going to be able to keep that up for, you know, as you say, 6 weeks, could be more than that. And if he doesn't, you know, he's going to kind of call the judge's bluff there, like see if he actually will put him behind bars if he doesn't come. I mean, where do you stand on that? Like, do you think he's going to be able to kind of take himself into the courtroom and sit quietly and polite and behave every day of this trial?
So one thing which is just completely has left a huge impression on me from doing this has been that to see how much time Trump is spending in courtrooms before the election. Like, yes, we have this criminal case where he is required to appear, but it's also important to remember there's all this other civil litigation he's been involved in. He's been to a lot of those hearings. We could have more, you know, the federal January 6th case. He could be tried in that in the final months before the election in November. So the upshot is that like his like final year before the election, potentially before he returns to office, will have been spent just in these courtrooms, you know, just as you said, like with matters completely out of his control, just forced to sit there, say nothing for 9 hours, maybe fall asleep, maybe pay attention to the legal, you know, to whatever the legal arguments are, and also just listen to people making like really disparaging comments about him, be it prospective jurors or judges or evidence, you know, or former associates or now witnesses. So that's like a, that's not a great recipe. The thing is like, we, you know, in terms of whether he's going to be able to last, like he hasn't, the problem is with criminal cases, you don't have a choice. Like he's legally required to appear here. And you can see him chafing against that. Like last week, he was less angry. I mean, he didn't look happy, but like yesterday he was visibly angry. He was showing up, if not late, like at the kind of line, like if the hearing was supposed to start at like 1:30, he would show up at like 1:29, like that kind of thing. He was like fidgeting. And also when he left, like the Secret Service kept us all for like 45 minutes after the trial day ended, supposedly because he was like, this is a rumor, but like supposedly because he was like taking quite a bit of a long time to get out. So it's just like weird sort of acting out thing, like style, things like that, which all feels like a response to, as you say, the confines of the trial. The fact that he is confined already, even if he's not incarcerated as a criminal defendant, and he has to act out somehow. That is my impression. You know, there was a really interesting piece in the New York Times this week about what would happen if he actually, if Merchan has a part of the contempt litigation, orders him into some kind of like temporary confinement, like if he has like sent him to jail. And like, you know, basically like they were talking about was like, I mean, it's like, I don't know if people are familiar with like Pablo Escobar, when they built him like a prison. It was also like a mansion. Like they're not gonna do it. Yeah. But they were talking about giving Trump like a private, like, you know, these like, you know, official state officials in New York, talking about giving him like the wing of a prison, or like, you know, renovating, like, or using like a prison that's not in use right now, and giving him part of that. Like, you basically, it would be very weird. Like he would have his own like little thing, which, you know, from one standpoint, probably is not comparable to the, what happened to you or me if we were ordered into like to Rikers Island for something. But at the same time, I think, you know, there is something to be said for the kind of victimization that he could claim. There's been an interesting thing with the contempt litigation as well, where he, his lawyers keep saying this is actually a First Amendment issue, which is like, it's not really at all. But the reason they say it's a First Amendment issue is because Trump is a politician, he's a candidate. And so they're saying that his statements, which are attacking witnesses, are in fact political, like responses to politics. Like he's making those statements in his capacity as a politician. And it's interesting because it kind of goes to the grievance issue, where what they're kind of implicitly saying, in my review, is not just a legal argument. It's also saying that you're saying to the judge, you're not just silencing Trump, you're silencing the nominee for the Republican from the Republican Party. He is speaking for them. He is running for president. He's responding to political attacks with political rhetoric. And so, you know, you need to back off because you're silencing half the country. And I think there's an interesting parallel there with what might happen if he is sent to jail, because then the argument is going to be, well, I mean, it's going to be like the same thing we've been hearing for a long time now. Like, you imprisoned a political opponent of President Biden was imprisoned, right? And they'll fudge, like, you know, how it happened or who did it, but that's how it would be read. And that's, I think, partly where the hesitation comes from, largely where the hesitation comes from. And I think that's also where the benefit potentially stands for Trump.
Right. Okay, so we're recording this Wednesday afternoon, the day off for the trial so far, and set to reconvene Thursday, right? So where will we pick up when that comes back?
So we will pick up with David Pecker testifying. He built up throughout Monday and Tuesday to the centerpiece of the prosecution's case, which is the hush money payments to Stormy Daniels. And we can expect him to narrate this in kind of an interesting way. My impression is that it's going to be centered around the Access Hollywood tape, which, you know, I think you mentioned this in the podcast yesterday, but it's like, it was the one moment in the campaign when Trump was really forced to try to issue a sincere apology, right? Because it was just so damaging and shocking. And so it's after that when potential Stormy Daniels allegations appear, and it's, you know, privately, not publicly at that point. And it's what causes the Trump campaign to try to buy her silence, right? This fear that after Access Hollywood, if you had another allegation around the treatment of women, it would just destroy it. So we can really expect Pecker, I think, to narrate both the broad sort of significance of it, like the context, and also give us a look at the details, because at the end of the day, he was, it was National Enquirer which bought her silence. So it'll be, yeah, I think it'll be that. And we, depending on how things go, we may also get to see cross-examination from the defense, which will be interesting because we're not, Tucker has been, he hasn't drawn the criticism from Trump that Michael Cohen or some of the other witnesses have. You know, if anything, like looking, watching him testify, he seems to still want to preserve some kind of relationship with Trump, which seems crazy to me. But it'll be interesting to see how far they go after his credibility. The big thing is that Pecker, he dealt a lot with Michael Cohen on these things, and it's not clear how much he dealt with Trump. So that's a big thing to watch. It's just how far can he go in implicating Trump, and how much of this is going to be restricted to Michael Cohen.
Okay, so that'll pick back up Thursday. Listeners, if you haven't already, definitely check out Josh's coverage. It's been so good and funny and so much less annoying than other people's coverage who are like obsessed with transcribing his every shift of his weight in his seat. So
yeah. It really is weird. Like, I don't want to like show my colleagues or whatever. It's like, it's like talking about him. Like if you ever go to the zoo, it's like keep writing and like people see like a gorilla or an orangutan. Yeah. And it's like, oh my God, he's picking up a stick like it's a pencil. Like it's really the same tone in how like people are talking about Trump. Like it's just like, I don't know. I find it very like weird.
Totally. So come to TPM for a much better treatment of the trial. And Josh, thanks so much for taking the time to come on. I know you must be like totally running on fumes by this point.
Thanks, Kate. I appreciate it.
Belaboring the Point with Kate Riga is a TPM podcast. The show is hosted by me, reporter Kate Riga. The show is produced by the excellent Jackie Wilhelm. Thanks to our good friend, Why Not Jansveld, for our podcast theme song. And thanks to our TPM members who make this possible. Rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts and subscribe wherever you listen.